Least of all, Emma and Claire.
No, they won't.
How are they?
Viola said, stopping, her voice plaintive. I believe Claire will be all right, but Emma... I don't know.
I'm terribly sick that our family has a part in this. I loved Bonnie. She was kind to me. I had very few friends, and she was one.
Her expression darkened.
My heart breaks. But how I feel doesn't matter. Not in comparison to how the girls must be feeling.
Mary noticed that Viola's hands were shaking. She had dropped the hem of her dress, and the silk of her skirt was absorbing the last of a small puddle, but Viola took no heed. Clearly, the tiny woman had something else on her mind besides an apology.
Jacob is smart, Viola went on, and good. It was his father who wanted him to defend Mr. Harley. Jacob didn't want to. He was afraid of what Elizabeth might think. But he's clever. I suppose all mothers say that.
She looked up, embarrassed.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean...
She gave up talking and ran a gloved hand up the door jamb. Mrs. Vanderveer,
Viola, please.
Viola. What is it that you came to say? She sighed and hesitated for a moment.
I collect French dolls. Very expensive. Jumeaux. I know to someone like you that seems frivolous.
She nodded at the clinic, in which nothing could be said to be frivolous.
But I like fashion. And the dolls are meant to show off the latest couture from Paris. I miss going there. I used to go with my father. I think I told you that at the party. Anyway, I like to see what is new.
She was talking fast now.
The dolls mean a lot to me. They're quite rare and difficult to find. No one in Albany sells them. You have to go to Manhattan, Viola. Jacob told me about the dolls sent to the girls.
Mary recalled how quickly Jacob had snatched them from her hands. She had caught a glimpse at the bottom of their shoes, the scroll of a French word embroidered into the silk.
He recognized them, the type of doll, that day at your house. He knows about my collection. I keep them in my bedroom.
Mary fought a sudden chill and reached for the shawl she had put aside when she was cleaning. The content of the note came suddenly back to her. Do you miss me? The dolls are yours.
You sent them? No.
Viola's hands, perpetually in motion, stilled.
No. They weren't mine.
How do you know?
I counted them. I'm certain. The ones that were sent to Emma and Claire did not come from my collection.
Then do you know who did send them?
I don't.
Did Jacob tell you there was a note? Viola's startled response told Mary that Jacob hadn't.
What did it say?
Mary didn't like to think of what the note had said. Its cool arrogance had unnerved her. I think you'd rather not know.
I see.
Viola swallowed.
I can't even imagine how awful this is for your family. It is for me. It has been for Jacob. I hardly see him anymore. During the day, he hides himself away somewhere preparing for the trial. He won't even tell me where he goes. He never wanted to be involved. But I told you that already.
Viola looked wistfully around the clinic. She was lingering, as if she had nowhere else to go. Mary wondered how she filled her days. I think you might like to know, Mary said, that Jacob was very good to Emma when he interviewed her. Very kind. Most of us appreciate his discretion. Very few attorneys would have treated her with such care.
I'm glad.
Viola's face lit with pride, but within seconds her expression fell again.
I suppose it's Elizabeth who is distressed.
She loves those girls. They are like sisters to her.
That's what Jacob says. He fears Elizabeth will never forgive him.
Mary shrugged. She couldn't speak for Elizabeth. Viola nodded ruefully and looked distractedly about the room, her attention flitting from object to object without seeming to register any of them. After a moment, she said,
Are you ever sorry that you married?
The question startled Mary, but Viola had spoken without self-pity, echoing the clear-eyed attitude about men that was most often voiced in this room. It was the rare prostitute who suffered any romantic notions about the male sex. No, I'm not sorry, Mary said. Viola nodded, envy glazing her eyes.
I thought so. You lead a life different from mine.
Jenny had once made that same observation to Mary. In it, there existed the implication that Mary possessed the courage to act in unexpected ways, while Jenny and Viola did not. Mary Stipp traveled where and when she would. Mary Stipp braved criticism to treat prostitutes and perform surgery. Viola, Mary said, who else knows that you collect those dolls? The petite woman blushed, looking more childish than ever.
I expect you think it's foolish.
Not at all. But I do wonder who else knows. Do you ever show them to people?
All the time. If I suspect someone might be interested, I offer them a tour. Before the dinner party, I showed them to Catherine Lansing. But the maids know about them, of course, and could tell anyone, I suppose. And the footman.
You said they aren't sold in Albany. Where do you buy them?
At a store in Manhattan City.
Do they know you? Have you been there, or do you send for them?
I've been there any number of times.
Do they keep records of who buys them? Viola's face lit up, and then she ducked her head in embarrassment.
They do. Every once in a while, they send me a letter to alert me that they've received a new doll or that they are expecting a shipment, and do I want to reserve one? They know I can't resist. I always buy one. Lately, I've had a standing order.
When was the last time you visited that store?
A year ago.
Mary raised her eyebrows, and Viola, understanding her unspoken question, said,
But my husband doesn't let me travel without his permission.
You could leave him a note, Mary said evenly. Later that day, as the 510 Express rocked over a causeway stretched across a small bay, a third of the way downriver, Viola studied an island lying mid-channel and buttressed at one end by a warning lighthouse. Some wreckage was splintered against the boulders at its northern tip. It took her a moment to understand that what she was seeing were the remnants of her husband's ice yacht, the Honey Girl. The battered runner, its mast snapped, was wedged in a crevice, its unfurled sails shredded and lapping on the rising tide. Viola could just make out the fanciful, looping letters H and G above the waves, the bright red paint having already crackled and turned dull. She shifted in her seat to point out the wreckage to Mary Stipp, but the doctor was staring straight ahead, resolute. Chapter 39. William woke to the sound of breaking waves. A thin gray light peeked through the louvers of the closed shutters of his corner room. In the 4 weeks they had spent in the Whaler's Rest, he had rested little. Often he woke in the dead of night, trying to think of a way to reach Emma. Loud noises startled her. She flinched at the slightest touch, even from Elizabeth or Amelia. With the trial date looming ever closer, It was less than 2 weeks away. She could not meet even the gaze of the people who loved her. To establish a semblance of ordinary life, Amelia had established a schedule. Emma and Claire spent each morning reading and writing, and after luncheon, William helped Emma review her numbers. Only then did a spark of interest flare in Emma's eyes. He paced her through the complexities of long division, heartened that at least one part of her mind had not dimmed. But invariably, afterward, she turned listless and retreated to her room to nap, fully clothed, the counterpane drawn up to her neck. By contrast, Claire reveled in the sea and sun. On the rare occasion when she could persuade Emma to join her on her afternoon visits to the beach, Emma evinced no joy in the exercise. Not even Elizabeth's daily violin practice could pierce Emma's armor. Emma had become a halting, flickering ghost, and William was terrified. He rose, dressed quickly in shirt and pants and muffler, and crept down the stairs to the dining room. The hall clock read 5. In the kitchen, the cooks bustled about, baking the day's bread. He begged a cup of coffee from them, and took a seat beside a drafty window, and stared through its leaded panes at the bay. Usually, the gray burned off by 10, revealing a clear blue wash of sky. But this early, the Cape remained cloaked in a gunmetal mist. With a sudden rustle of skirts, Amelia, pale-eyed and serious, appeared at his elbow. He retrieved another cup of coffee from the cooks, who donated a plate of warm rolls and jam to their impromptu breakfast. "I have an idea about Emma," William said, after ferrying this bounty to the table.
"And I have one about Elizabeth."
Emma did not own a riding habit, nor had she ridden much, being a city girl. Amelia borrowed a close woolen jacket from the innkeeper's daughter for Emma to wear over her pink calico dress. Then, to protect Emma from the sun, they tied the ribbons of her sun hat so that its brim lay flat against her cheeks. Elizabeth pinned a makeshift veil of lace to the crown, and she was ready. The herring fisherman who rented William the horse held the bay mare by the bridle as William lifted Emma up on his shoulder so that she could pet the animal's long neck. The mare nuzzled her in return, nickering softly.
"See how gentle she is," the fisherman said. "My children ride a bareback."
William mounted first, and then the fisherman helped settle Emma on the saddle in front of William. She submitted to the fisherman's grasp, but went limp as he lifted her. William tucked her side saddle between him and the pommel, secured his arm around her waist, and whispered,
"I'm here." "Head into the sun," the fisherman said. "It's only 2 miles to the back shore. When you reach the beach, you can turn either way, but southerly would be best for what you have in mind. Don't worry about the scrub. The mare will pick her way through it."
The scrub turned out to be squat live oaks that clustered together on the low sandy plateau between the eastern and western shores of the narrow tip of the peninsula. The trees grew close together, their twisting branches intertwined and gnarled by the salt wind. Gooseberry vines clung to the furrowed bark where they weren't usurped by wild grape. There were a few freshwater ponds, but no one lived up here. Throughout the ride, Emma remained silent, her reaction to this forced expedition and the landscape shielded from his view by the obscuring veil. She had not asked where they were going or why. They breached the headlands after only a half-hour's ride, emerging from the salted forest out onto a dazzling plain of sand. Breaking waves hurled themselves at the beach from a great distance out, their constant roar prohibiting any conversation. Here and there, broken masts and wrecks marred the great frothing expanse. To mark their point of entry, William made note of a bulky heron's nest perched on a high branch of one of the oaks. Then he steered the horse down a shallow switchback of sand and glacial till to the deserted beach. As recommended, he turned southward, veering toward the shore until the mare was waiting at the ocean's edge. William guided the animal around bobbing flotsam and mats of seagrass, as mackerel gulls hovering on the steady wind followed them like pilot fish. Plovers sprinted across the glassy shore. Far wilder than the bay, the ocean heaved up again and again, the dark roiling waves rimmed with sparkling white foam. After riding for several miles, they reached a bluff that soared a couple hundred feet above the beach. William found shelter from the constant wind at its base and drew Emma off the mare. He tethered the horse to one of the heavier pieces of silvery driftwood flung up against the dunes. Amelia had persuaded the cooks to pack them a lunch, and he spread out a blanket and unwrapped meat sandwiches and scones and bottles of ginger ale. The ocean magnified the sun's rays, and Emma blinked as she chewed, for she'd had to remove her protective veil in order to eat. But after a while, she lay aside her unfinished sandwich and lay back on the blanket to doze in the sun, a light breeze ruffling the lace on her dress and the ribbons of her hat. Even in repose, she looked battle-weary. William looked out toward the sea, biding his time. The immense watery vista reminded William of the wide desert of Texas and the lesser charms of the Rio Grande. Before the war, he had enlisted and served in an army outpost there, trying to recover from his own paralyzing grief after his first wife, Genevieve, died in a cholera epidemic in Manhattan City. But nothing lifted him from his despair, not until a young Mexican girl named Liliana, who worked as a laundress, entered his life. 14, 13, she was pregnant by a soldier there, and whether she'd been raped or not, William had never been able to determine. He had delivered her child, and then been parent to them both. Then the war had broken out, and he had had to leave them behind. Loving Liliana and her son had saved him. Now, Emma needed saving. She slept for a good hour before she stirred. She sat up, resting her elbows on her knees and squinting out to sea. William feared her great silence might kill her. He didn't need to coax from her the details of what had happened to her. He'd heard them once already when she'd told the district attorney. And he doubted she would want to repeat them now without Amelia or Elizabeth at her side. And to what purpose, anyway? Reliving the horror would only rekindle her smoldering fear. He was just gratified that she was not afraid of him. He wished Mary were here. She had already formed a great bond with a girl. "Come with me, Emma." He took her small hand, and she rose obediently. Too obediently. He wanted her to refuse, to fight for herself. But she did not even ask where they were going. He headed up the steep escarpment behind them, following a shallow crevice riven into the hillside. Reed, like seagrass, gave some purchase, but it was hard going, for Emma had little strength and the sand gave way beneath their feet and filled their shoes. After 15 minutes, they'd only gotten a quarter of the way up. She sank to the ground and he had to reach out and catch her so that she wouldn't somersault backward.
"I can't," Emma said, close to tears.
It was the first thing she had said to him all day.
"It's too hard."
"It is hard, isn't it?"
He perched beside her, a bit out of breath himself, grateful for the cooling wind. Emma's refusal contained the hoped-for spark of defiance, but it also contained a miasma of defeat. He would have far preferred that she had screamed, "I won't."
"Can we go back?"
she said.
"Sure," he said, nodding. "We could go back. But then we'd never know what it looks like up there, or whether all this hard work is worth it." but I'm told that up there, you can see as far as forever. But we won't know unless we go up and see.
Emma untied a boot and tipped it over. A waterfall of yellow grains blew away in the breeze. She tugged off the other one and repeated the process, unrolling her stockings and tugging them off too. Her movements were precise, orderly. Wind rustled the dune grass, and the ocean pulsed with the rhythmic pounding of a heartbeat. Below, the tethered mare munched on a bunch of beach grass.
"Do you remember from before, Emma, when you climbed trees?"
The girl squinted at him from underneath her hat, her gaze wary.
"Well, that cliff up there is higher than you've ever been in your life. You might see ships. You might see all the way to England."
She looked at him doubtfully. He grinned.
"I'm exaggerating. Not England, of course. But ships, maybe."
Her tentative nod predicted nothing.
"I want to ask you another question, Emma. You don't have to answer me if you don't want to."
She neither granted nor withheld permission, so he forged ahead.
"I wonder whether you don't want to keep going because you're scared, or because it's too hard to keep climbing?"
She stared for a while into the distance, then looked back at him and whispered, "Both."
"I see. This cliff is pretty steep. But I bet everything feels hard and frightening to you right now."
She looked away.
"Emma, do you remember that I told you that when we go back home, you have to go to court to tell a judge and jury about what happened to you and Claire?"
"Yes."
"And do you remember that I told you that there will be people in the courtroom?"
She nodded. He had relayed all this in their first week on Cape Cod, one afternoon on the veranda when they had the place to themselves. But he had not been certain that she had understood or remembered his descriptions of the workings of a courtroom, or the roles of a judge and jury, or even that she would have to testify.
"You remember that in a couple of weeks, Mr. Hoteling and Mr. Vanderveer will ask you questions, just like they did before at the house. The reason that it's important that you answer them is so that we can find out who the other man is. And you are the only one who can help the judge."
She turned attentive, watchful. He hesitated now. He wanted neither to coddle nor push her, and he certainly did not want to coerce her. But there was no way out. She had to get on that witness stand to testify, and they all had to help her do it. There were times when he wished they'd not reported a damn thing, because in the end, what purpose would the trial serve if Emma was destroyed by it?
"You see, Emma, I'm just a little worried about you."
Her eyes grew hollow and fearful, but also darkly luminous. Someone had noticed her. Someone had seen her. At least, this is what William hoped she understood.
"I brought you out here today, not just because it's beautiful, but also so that you could practice doing something really hard. This is a tall hill, the tallest one around. It's not a great big mountain, but the sand in our shoes and the wind are going to make it pretty hard to get up there. It's already hard for me, and I'm a grown man. But one of the things about life is that when you do something hard and succeed, then you learn that things aren't as scary or hard as they seem. And when you're done, you feel like you can do anything. It's one of those important things people have to learn. And you already did a very brave thing once. You saved yourself and Claire by hitting that man with a shovel and escaping. I'm so proud of you for that.
A ghost of a smile flickered across her face. He would leave it at this. If there were more time before the trial, leave her with no other challenge for the day than to regard herself as admired. But there wasn't more time.
No doubt about it. You're a soldier, Emma. As brave as they come. In fact, I brought something for you.
He fished in his shirt pocket for the Medal of Honor he'd earned at Gettysburg for meritorious medical service. Exhumed now from its velvet box, the brass eagle and star flashed in the bright sun, and the flag's red and white stripes shone vibrant against the pale yellow sands. He was breaking several army regulations for what he was about to do, but he didn't care.
I earned this in the war, for doing some really hard things, and I want you to wear it now, because you've done some really hard things. May I pin it on you?
She nodded, and he took great care of fixing it to her dress. She fingered it and looked up at him. Once during the war, at Fairfax Station, surrounded by thousands and thousands of dying men, he had said to Mary, "Choose who you are. Choose who you'll be." He could not say that now to this ravaged child, but the situation was just as dire, the choice just as necessary.
"I just want it all to be over," Emma whispered. "I don't want to think about him anymore."
"Do you think about him a lot?"
"All the time."
"I can tell. I thought you've been awfully scared and unhappy. And now it seems as if you want to hide forever. I don't blame you one bit. It was awful, what happened to you. But I'm sorry to tell you that you have to save yourself one more time. Now, I'm not going to tell you to climb that hill. You have to want to, for yourself. But I think it will help you later."
He wanted to say, "It's either hide forever or see forever." He wanted to say, "You need to choose." He wanted to say, "Follow me. I'll show you." Instead, he held his breath, nodded solemnly, and looked out to sea, pretending to watch the hundreds of seagulls whirling in flight. The sun was behind them now, and the cliff was casting long shadows onto the beach. They didn't have much time before they would have to return to the hotel, and this gambit would only work once. After this attempt, he had no idea what else he could do for her besides protecting her, which he would do no matter what. But that would shore her up for only so long. Every inch toward courage was a decision. Even 10 feet on her own would be a triumph. The line between coercion and choice for her was the line between darkness and light. He would never push her, but she needed to choose to climb this hill. If she didn't, she wouldn't have the courage to climb onto the witness stand, or perhaps even to walk down a street on her own. Emma tugged at his sleeve.
"Do you think I can do it?"
He pretended to consider this very important question, as if in fact there were two answers, when there was really only one. He nodded solemnly.
I do. I think you can.
The sprinkle of freckles on her face had darkened. He should have remembered to pin her veil back on, but if he moved one inch either up or down the hill, he would influence her decision. She searched his face, her blue eyes reflecting the clouds scudding along on the wind. She fingered the metal instead of the pearl buttons of her dress. Then she climbed to her feet and shot up the hill, her skirts bunched in her hands, her shoes and stockings forgotten in the dune grass. William climbed to his feet, gathered her things, and started after her up the sandy path. Here and there, grasses were uprooted where Emma had grabbed for a handhold. At each twist and turn, he expected to find her slumped on the sand, but as he slipped and fought his way up the unforgiving verge, her footsteps grew more fleet. He found her perched on the precipice of the headland, her legs dangling over the cliff edge. Thoreau had once said of this very place, "A man may stand there and put all America behind him." Well, a girl could too. The brilliant light dazzled. The wide beach stretched to the north and south. Beyond the long sandy bar, the sea sparkled in the sunlight. William sat down next to Emma. She was winded and breathing hard, but her cheeks were dappled with sun and exertion and pride. The metal glinted in the sun. They were the only people for miles. They could see forever.
"We could count the waves," Emma said.
And so they began. Chapter 40. After William rode away with Emma, Elizabeth and Amelia abandoned Claire's schooling for a morning constitutional along the beach. There was an ebb tide, and low waves were breaking in a soothing, gentle rhythm. Claire found a piece of driftwood and began to poke at the bubbling clam holes dotting the sand. She wore a pair of rubber boots they'd purchased for her in a shop on Commercial Street, and they peeked out from underneath her dress when she leaned over to inspect the effect of her labors. A light breeze smelled of brine and sea foam. Out of the corner of her eye, Amelia studied Elizabeth. The sea air and daily practice had done them all good, but Elizabeth was not herself. She had freckled some in the sun, despite their wide hats, and she was attentive to the girls, but she lacked luster.
"You're sounding wonderful on your instrument, Lizzie," Amelia said.
And she was. The whole town was enthralled. Her practices had transformed into impromptu concerts, and townspeople found reason to abandon dinner preparations and chores to be seated outside the veranda when she played.
"The violin goes out of tune so quickly in the sea air."
"Well, I can't tell. I think you may sound even better than when you left Paris."
They walked on, following Claire, who was chasing a seagull. Amelia said,
"I've held off asking you, Lizzie, but can you tell me now why you wanted to leave Paris?"
"The girls,"
Elizabeth said, her answer swift.
"But you were unhappy before. You were on the verge of quitting before we left. I could tell."
Elizabeth's mouth set in rueful embarrassment.
"You think I play well because you love me, Grandmama, but I don't. And they knew it at the school. Monsieur Gérard, he made me understand that. He told me every day that I might as well not even be there since I was taking the place of someone far more talented."
A wave of fury washed over Amelia. She recalled the man's cool, good looks, the arrogant cant to his shoulders, his ingratiating bonhomie.
"He said what?"
Elizabeth held up her hand.
"Don't make me tell you any more. It's humiliating."
"Every day?"
Tears formed in Elizabeth's eyes, and she looked away, tight-lipped.
"He said I have no talent. that I am not technically versatile. But if I ever dared try to join an orchestra, I would garner no success. He advised me to go home, to give up. And then Emma and Claire died.
They both watched Claire skipping along the beach, flicking at the wet sand with her stick, sending ribbons of seaweed flying into the sky.
Monsieur Gerard was relentless with his criticism, and punishing, and cruel.
Cruel? Did he hurt you?
Amelia said, instantly alert.
No. No. Elizabeth shook her head. It's nothing like that.
Amelia exhaled. She would never forgive herself if Elizabeth, too, had been harmed the way the girls had been.
He had no right.
Charles Gérard is the preeminent violinist of France. I think he knew what he was talking about.
Listen to me. He had his own reasons to discourage you. The director himself told me that you might soon surpass him in skill. No doubt that small man feared your ascendance. And you, a girl. He must have been humiliated.
Grandmama,
do you know that your Aunt Mary had the same difficulty? No one wanted her to be a physician. The Albany Medical School rejected her out of hand. To get what she wanted, she had to go to war. And even then she had to fight everyone. Dorothea Dix, even William.
Yes,
she said, to Elizabeth's incredulous look.
Obviously William came around, but my point is that it wasn't easy for her. Darling, you can't just let one man undermine your life.
But he's the one who would know.
I'll grant you that Monsieur Gérard is a great violinist, but that does not render him free of prejudice or jealousy, or even malevolence.
Elizabeth stopped abruptly.
Paris is not the only conservatory in the world, Amelia said. There is Boston. You could audition while we are here.
I can't. I won't leave the girls.
It's just one day, darling. Right, why don't you? Take the train over, or we'll even hire a boat. It's a day trip. I'll go with you. And if the conservatory doesn't accept you, then in turn I'll accept your assessment of your own playing, but not until then. Because I know that some men don't like to be usurped. And I also know that when you play, darling, it's the most beautiful sound in the world.
Elizabeth shook her head and closed her eyes.
But how could he have said those things, Grandmama?
Envy and fear make people unkind. I wish I'd known what was happening to you in Paris. Write Boston today, Elizabeth, when we get back to the hotel. Will you?
Elizabeth nodded, and they turned and walked across the beach to where Claire had scampered to the ocean edge and was letting wavelets lap over the tips of her boots.
And what of Jacob?
Elizabeth said quietly, so that Claire would not overhear her question.
Why has he betrayed us?
Perhaps he has no choice.
Of course he has a choice. Who could defend such a man as Mr. Harley? How can Jacob look at Emma and Claire and then make an argument in his favor? I will never understand.
Lizzie, in the last few months you've lost a lot. Bonnie, for a while Emma and Claire, the conservatory.
But what I think you've really lost is your heart.
Elizabeth turned. But I can't love the girls and Jacob at the same time.
Maybe you can, Amelia said. Maybe you already do.
A few days later, Elizabeth stood in the studio of Ulius Eichberg, the director and founder of the Boston Conservatory. A German violinist, he had granted Elizabeth an audition by immediate return letter. His nascent conservatory could not have differed more from the bustling Paris Conservatoire and its marble, colonnaded home on the Rue Bergère. The Boston Conservatory, operating now for only 22 years, did not have its own building. It rented rooms on the second and third floors in the Mason and Hamlin Organ Company's factory. Its marble dolomite facade fronted the Boston Common, but one gained admission to the school by a back door off an alley and up a wooden stairwell open to the workshop floor, from which emanated a great deal of hammering and sawing. Upstairs, Eichberg's drafty studio had been arranged like a parlor, with a brocade settee, mahogany tables, and rich tapestry hangings on the walls. Overlapping Turkish rugs in hues of red and blue carpeted the entire floor, buffering any sound from the factory below. A jury made up of the three members of the core violin faculty occupied three ladder-back chairs arranged in a semicircle. They each rose when she entered and offered her their hands in greeting. Ulius Eichberg had a kindly face, not unlike the director of the Paris Conservatory, but there was something far less challenging in his expression.
"Begin when you are ready," he said.
His genial greeting to both Amelia and Elizabeth had put Elizabeth at ease, and as she lifted her bow, she strove to banish Monsieur Gerard's voice from her mind. She had chosen to play Viotti's Violin Concerto No. 17 again, the piece that had earned her entrance to Paris, for despite its brevity, just over 10 minutes, no other music in her repertoire demonstrated a player's dexterity and phrasing in as little time. Noble, gripping, but deceptively light and bright, the solo alluded to the darker orchestral underpinning that the jurists would not hear, for there was no orchestra to mask the tones of her instrument. And she would be handicapped by the fact that this new violin was not nearly as expressive or sensuous as her instrument at home. But therein lay the challenge. If Emma could summit a cliff, then Elizabeth could coax eloquence from lesser wood. With the first note of the Allegretto, Elizabeth slipped into the concerto's strains. She did not hear the music as much as she saw it, shimmering and changing with each stroke of her bow. Once she had tried to explain this to her early instructors, but no one understood what she meant, and so she stopped explaining it to anyone. But this was how she remembered music. She saw it. And this piece of music, in D minor, looked like the colors of hope. She shut her eyes, giving in to the luster and brilliance of the melody emanating from her instrument. Playing was effortless. She forgot Monsieur Gerard, forgot Paris, forgot her fear. There was only music and joy. When she finished the piece, she came back to herself slowly, the last note lingering in the air as the colors dissolved. She was still catching her breath when Mr. Eichberg, glancing first at the other faculty, who each nodded, said,
"Miss Fall, I don't know how the conservatoire ever parted with you, but I will happily take their loss as my gain."
Book 3. Chapter 41. On Monday, June 16th, the first day of the Court of Sessions, the city's working classes awoke at dawn, conscious of the immensity of the moment, and decided en masse to flock to City Hall. From first light, they elbowed for position in front of the white-pillared cake box of a building, spilling onto Eagle Street and down the slope of Maiden Lane, in hopes of either being admitted to the courtroom or catching a glimpse of Emma O'Donnell, who they were now calling the Sullied Girl. Since Emma and Claire's miraculous resurrection, the mystery of their whereabouts had become a question of sport, debated with passion, in every tavern, prayer circle, factory, horse car, railroad depot, restaurant, brewery, shop, and home. Because despite the newspaper report that the Stips were housing them, there hadn't been a single sighting. Patients reported that William Stipp was unavailable, while Dr. Mary Stipp deflected even the most timorous inquiry. A cobbler's claim of an order for shoes sized by penciled outlines created a frenzy, but was dismissed as implausible when he could not produce a bill of sale. A porter of the Boston and Albany Railroad claimed that he had seen them depart one May night, but his superiors, fearful of a mob, immediately discounted him. A tantalizing rumor of the female Dr. Stipp taking a holiday in Manhattan City emerged to some acclaim. However, this too was quashed. The only place civility reigned was among Emma and Claire's classmates, who would answer no one's questions, a decorum modeled for them by their teacher, who was still mortified by her role in the sisters' disappearance, and who, upon hearing of their reappearance, had wept for a day. The family of the former principal, hobbled by a dual amputation for frostbite and since confined to a wheelchair, was gauging her laudanum consumption carefully and had since the blizzard, for she had threatened to end her life over her disastrous decision that had imperiled Emma and Claire O'Donnell. As the crowd waited to see the sisters for themselves, a general camaraderie prevailed, along with a consensus that the hero of the flood was still a hero. It was not clear whether or not Emma would testify. That prospect, too, had been bandied about in the newspapers, as if she were an injured prize thoroughbred slated to race in the Traverse Stakes at Saratoga. There had been hints of a subpoena, soundly denied by the prosecutor's office. But the longer people shivered in the cool of the early morning, speculation was stoked into avid fervor. By 7 o'clock, the night watchman, who usually slept in the doldrums of the early dawn hours, tucked into a comfortable corner of the mayor's office, was roused by the noise and went to unlock the great iron doors. But before he did, he perceived the enormity of the waiting crowd, and instead telephoned the exchange, a step he had never once taken in his sleepy 5-year incumbency as nocturnal protector of one of the prettiest buildings in Albany. He implored the operators to call the city building at Hamilton and Pearl to send as many policemen as they could, because the citizens of Albany had declared themselves newly besotted with justice, and he was afraid for his life. Within half an hour, mounted policemen circled the throng and herded the restive crowd onto the grounds of the Albany Academy, pinning them there with billy clubs and shields, while grand jurors and prospective trial jurors and witnesses and court officials slipped inside unobserved and undetected via the lowly back door normally used only for the transfer of prisoners to and from the jail next door. Officer Farrell drove to the Stipps' house and escorted them to the courthouse via a circuitous route and snuck them inside by the same method. With every passing hour, the racket in the streets mounted and invaded even the stately chambers of the courtroom on the third floor, giving the impression of impending revolution. Nonetheless, by 10 in the morning, an efficient grand jury handed down a swift indictment of James Harley, and by noon the task of choosing trial jurors had turned out to be an expedient and surprisingly harmonious march through the available jury pool. At noon, the judge called for recess, and it wasn't until 1 o'clock that an army of guards opened the doors to the public. The mayor was tagged with the onerous duty of choosing who was to be admitted, a job he accomplished on the basis of elevated stature in the community, a prejudice not unmarked by the unruly crowd, who jeered as police barred the doors behind the final candidate. At 1:30, William Stipp and Elizabeth entered the courtroom, having spent the morning with Mary and Emma in a holding room across the echoing mezzanine. A hush fell over the overflow crowd that packed the pews and jostled for position, too deep along every wall. The wide wings of Elizabeth's bonnet served as blinders, but William saw every curious stare following them up the aisle. The presence of the Cornings and Ten Eycks and Schuylers surprised him. Madame Hubbard waved a handkerchief at them, oblivious that her plumed hat was causing a great deal of trouble for the spectators seated behind her. Horace Young caught William's gaze and dutifully recorded something in his notebook. But Garrett and Viola Vanderveer, curiously, were not among the crowd. William steered Elizabeth into the pew directly behind the prosecutor's table. He was glad that his witnesses, Emma and Mary, were excluded from the courtroom, and that Amelia had stayed behind to take care of Claire, who hardly even knew that the trial was taking place. The district attorney and Jacob were already in their seats, studying sheaves of documents and notes, feigning oblivion to the gallery. James Harley met no one's gaze. He sat slumped in his seat beside Jacob. His time in jail had wizened him, and his beard had gone completely white, though he wore a new linen frock coat and thin vest that unfortunately had already wrinkled in the heat. A door opened behind the bench and the jury filed in. The smattering of laborers, stonecutters and masons and the like, drew sharp scrutiny from the gallery, but it was the presence of Harmon Pompelli that was greeted with a collective inhalation of astonishment. As president of the Albany Gas Lighting Company, Albany Savings Bank, and Albany Insurance, Pompelli was known to everyone. The rest of the jury threw self-conscious glances at the crowd, but Pompelli, chosen as foreman, nodded to the assembled as if he were the judge himself, lending a further air of gravity to the trial.
"All rise!"
At the bailiff's reedy cry, Judge Julius Thayer, attired in a voluminous robe and powdered wig, marched into the courtroom, and with an impatient wave, commanded everyone back into their seats. Throughout Albany, Thayer's adherence to the law had achieved legendary status. At nearly 50, the big man was stone-faced and glum, his visage cemented in impassivity. A bulbous nose, thick jowls undisguised by a thatch of beard, and a heavy forehead gave an impression of rigorous authority that his tired gaze did nothing to dispel. His wife Alice had died 6 weeks ago during childbirth, but not before producing a fifth daughter. The wet nurse was rumored to be unreliable in her milk, and neighbors reported that the child frequently cried all night. Now Thayer's exhausted gaze raked courtroom and spectators alike, before calling the courtroom to order with a sharp rap of his gavel.
"I want to take a moment to make clear that this court is fully cognizant of the infamy of this case."
Thayer's was a rumbling growl of a voice, thick with catarrh, but loud enough to rise above the din outside.
"If there is any misbehavior on the part of the gallery, I will not hesitate to clear this courtroom. During this trial, there will be revelations that will prove shocking to some, particularly any ladies who have been foolish enough to attend, though presumably that is why many of you are here. I find your interest especially to be suspect."
He glowered at them, and the women ducked their heads, embarrassed to be singled out.
"Nevertheless, here you all are. I warn each one of you to hold your tongues. I care nothing for your standing in the community or any privilege you may feel you possess. This is my courtroom, and I will kick out the lot of you if you even so much as peep."
He swept the courtroom again with his eagle-eyed gaze, reinforcing his avowal of intolerance.
"I now call the case of the people of Albany County versus Mr. James Harley. Will the clerk please swear in the jury?"
The 12 men charged with Harley's fate wobbled to their feet, seemingly stunned by the judge's stern warning, and then by the oath they took, with the exception of Harmon Pompelli, who seemed pleased after Thayer's rebuke to have official cause to be present. Though it was only June, and the real swelter was at least a month away, the afternoon sun was already boiling through the 5 tall, south-facing windows. Several men had removed their hats and were fanning themselves against the heat, but Thayer seemed unperturbed. He nodded at Lansing Hotailing, who strolled to the jury box to make his opening statement. The district attorney was known for doggedness, not eloquence. But despite this tepid reputation, this afternoon the entire courtroom hoped for oratory. Unlike Jacob, who appeared to great advantage in a cutaway coat and white waistcoat, crisp even in the rising heat, Ho Tae-ling's formal jacket hung on him like a sack. The two stood in odd juxtaposition to one another, the polished novice and the rumpled veteran.
"May it please the court, Mr. Foreman, and each of you gentlemen, the defendant in this case, one James Harley," Ho Tae-ling said, nodding at Harley, "is indicted for the high crimes of rape, kidnapping, and imprisonment. These are egregious crimes. Unconscionable. A bane on good society. Even just one of these terrible acts would give rise to abhorrence in the most hardened heart. Now, some of you may recognize Mr. Harley's name in connection with the recent flood. A certain member of the press has dubbed Mr. Harley a hero in connection with his rescue of two little boys. Well, I adjure you to banish that accolade from your mind, because Mr. Harley is not a hero. Mr. Harley is a wolf."
Though Ho Tae-ling's intonation was workmanlike and plodding, the courtroom was entranced, breathless at his every turn of phrase. No one pulled even a handkerchief from pocket or reticule, even as tiny beads of sweat formed on their foreheads.
"Members of the jury," Ho Tae-ling continued, his voice as dull as a broken bell, "at the conclusion of this case, His Honor the Judge Julius Thayer will charge you with the law and explain to you in detail just what the laws are governing in this case. He will explain definitions by penal law, and you will make a judgment. My job is to recite the facts as I intend to present them through the witnesses I call to the stand. The victims in this case are Emma and Claire O'Donnell, 10 and 7 years old. On March 12th of this year, at about noon, their principal expelled them from the Van Zandt Grammar School into the aftermath of our recent and devastating blizzard. The going was treacherous. Emma O'Donnell will tell you that her sister had trouble navigating the high drifts and soon sank, whereupon an unidentified man pulled Claire from the snowdrift and took them both to James Harley's house, where Mr. Harley secreted them in the cellar of his home at 153 Green Street, and thereafter kept them against their will for 6 weeks. They escaped from his basement the night of April 21st, the night of our recent great flood. The policeman who found them on a nearby street will tell you that upon hearing their names and recognizing them as the missing sisters long declared dead, he took them to the Stipp residence. They were bruised, troubled, and in a state of shock. Dr. Mary Stipp later examined them and informed the policeman that one of the two girls, Emma O'Donnell, had been interfered with in a sexual way.
The jury shifted in their seats. No one in the courtroom uttered a sound, not even a cough. A thick silence hung in the air, a bated expectancy that governed every move, twitch of eyelid, or mouth.
"The defendant, James Harley, was apprehended 2 days later. Gentlemen of the jury, if I establish the facts of the case, the county expects you to return a verdict of guilty on all counts in accordance with the evidence and what the facts in this case will warrant. And though Emma O'Donnell is at the age of consent, she in no way consented to the activity forced upon her."
Ho Tae-ling finished and ambled back to his table, appearing quite satisfied with his delivery. Judge Thayer turned to Jacob.
"Does the defense wish to make an opening statement?"
Jacob rose. In his beautifully tailored clothes, he cut a fine figure. But from his close vantage point, William noticed that the boy's hands were shaking, as if he were acutely aware that his smart attire could not disguise his age or inexperience. Jacob riffled through some papers, laid them down, then took hold of them again. Where, William thought, was Gerrit Vanderveer? Or for that matter, Viola? Were they indeed going to leave the boy without even an ounce of familial support?